This morning we continue the study about what the church should be doing collectively, and we're talking about the local church and its work. And we want to note that if these things that we're discussing are the work of the church, if these things are the work of the church, and I believe they are, then as much as there is within us ability to do them, they ought to be done. In other words, these things are not optional. These things are not optional as much as within our ability lies to do them. And secondly, we should then shun and reject those things that are not the work of the church and the things that are not revealed in the New Testament. This is God's design that we're trying to discover in the New Testament. And when we do these things and we are walking by faith, we know that this is what pleases God. The two things we've looked at then have been evangelism and the church edifying itself. And then finally, we're going to look at this idea of benevolence, relieving its own needy. And so if you have an outline, we're in lesson 13, and we're on the third page of that, I believe it would be, about halfway down. And so the church has been assigned the work of relieving its own needy saints. And the word is often used to describe this as benevolence. That word is used in the New Testament, but not in regard to the church's work. So I'm just saying the word benevolence could be found in some translations of the New Testament, but not in regard to this work we're talking about. The word benevolence means a disposition to do good, an act of kindness, a generous gift. So it is right that we describe relieving needy saints as an act of benevolence, an act of kindness, a generous gift. And we'll see those things as we read through these scriptures. The first point that we want to see, and what I'd like to do is, I've organized the outline here a little differently maybe than what we'll do, but I want us to go through the scriptures that regard this work of the local church. And we'll begin by looking in Acts chapter 2 and verses 44 through 45. Acts 2, 44 through 45. And there's going to be things then that we learn by putting all of these things together about the church's work in relieving its own needy saints. You recall in Acts 2, then the occasion is the day of Pentecost, a particular day of Pentecost, one that came after the Lord's resurrection. And when the church was established, the church began, the gospel was first preached, beginning in Jerusalem. And verse 40, then beginning in the context, Luke records, and with many other words, he testified and exhorted them, saying, "Be saved from this perverse generation." Then those who gladly received his word were baptized. And that day about 3,000 souls were added to them. And they continued steadfastly in the apostles' doctrine and fellowship, in the breaking of bread and in prayers. Then fear came upon every soul, and many wonders and signs were done through the apostles. Now all who believed were together and had all things in common, and sold their possessions and goods, and divided them among all, as anyone had need. So continuing daily with one accord in the temple, and breaking bread from house to house, they ate their food with gladness and simplicity of heart, praising God and having favor with all the people. And the Lord added to the church daily those who were being saved. There is not a lot said about the how here, but what we do know is that the first Christians there, that they had things in common, they sold possessions and divided them among all as anyone had need. Several things to point out. The sharing of things with others, the selling of possessions and goods in order to divide among all. The context there of the all is saints. But we'll see that as we go into Acts chapter 4 also. The context among all is the saints. Secondly, that it was as anyone had need. So I realize somebody from the world might take two verses out of Acts 2 and try to defend a communistic society or something and say, well, look, everybody just took everything that they had and everybody was required to sell everything that they have and just put it in a common pool, and then they divided it evenly. Now, see, that's not what that says, but that's what someone could take wrongly and misapply that. But we're going to see in Acts chapter 4 even more information that helps us understand what was done. The purpose of this collecting, the selling and then the collecting, was to supply those who were in need. Those who had need, and it was among saints. It was saints for saints. We're not told much more about how it was done. But when we get to Acts chapter 4 now, we have even more information about this. In Acts 4 and verses 32 through 35, now the multitude of those who believed were of one heart and one soul. Neither did anyone say that any of the things he possessed was his own, but they had all things in common. And with great power the apostles gave witness to the resurrection of the Lord Jesus. And great grace was upon them all. Nor was there anyone among them who lacked. For all who were possessors of lands or houses sold them and brought the proceeds of the things that were sold and laid them at the apostles' feet, and they distributed to each as anyone had need. And Joseph, who was also named Barnabas by the apostles, which is translated son of encouragement, a Levite of the country of Cyprus, having land, sold it and brought the money and laid it at the apostles' feet. But a certain man named Ananias with Sapphira his wife sold a possession, and he kept back part of the proceeds, his wife also being aware of it, and brought a certain part and laid it at the apostles' feet. But Peter said, Ananias, why has Satan filled your heart to lie to the Holy Spirit and keep back part of the price of the land for yourself? While it remained, was it not your own? And after it was sold, was it not in your own control? Why have you conceived this thing in your heart? You have not lied to men, but to God. Then Ananias, hearing these words, fell down and breathed his last. So great fear came upon all those who heard these things. And the young men arose and wrapped him up and carried him out and buried him. Now it was about 3 hours later when his wife came in, not knowing what had happened. And Peter answered her, tell me whether you sold the land for so much. And she said, yes, for so much. Then Peter said to her, how is it that you have agreed together to test the Spirit of the Lord? Look, the feet of those who have buried your husband are at the door, and they will carry you out. Then immediately she fell down at his feet and breathed her last. And the young men came in and found her dead, and carrying her out, buried her by her husband. So great fear came upon all the church and upon all who heard these things. I didn't have that marked as something to read, but it applies to what we're trying to contemplate here about how this was done. We see, beginning in 4:32 and through chapter 5, it is clear that anyone who sold their lands or possessions or houses did it of their own free will. It was neither coerced nor required. It was of their own free will. And secondly, even when they sold it, it was in their control. There is a difference between your money and the Lord's money. When it's in your control, before you have given it for its purpose and laid it, quote, at the apostles' feet, it's in your control to do with as you wish. Obviously, the Lord wants us to be good stewards and all that. That's not what we're talking about here. But it was under their control to sell it. It was under their control how to handle the proceeds. So If we think back now to Acts chapter 2, those who sold their possessions, they would have done it at their own free will, not coerced nor required. But they had what? They had this attitude, chapter 4 and 32. Neither did anyone say that any of the things that he possessed was his own. So the idea was, if you need it and you're in need, I'm willing to part with it and help you. That's what that's trying to show us, their care for each other. And so this was not a communistic system where everybody was required to put in everything that they own and it was then divided evenly. That was of one's own free will. Having put that aside then, again, we see as anyone had need in verse 35. Distribution was made according to as anyone had need. That's not communism. That's as anyone had need. Those who had need, distribution was made to them. Those funds from the sale of possessions was brought and laid at the apostles' feet. And I don't believe literally Luke means that as they stood or they sat, that people came and they set money by their feet and their toes. They brought it and put it under their control, under the apostles' control. And at this time, the apostles were still in charge of distributing to, as anyone had need. When we get to chapter 6, they say, we can't be doing this anymore. The word of God must not be neglected, for which we've been called. And so appoint 7 men from among you to handle this business. And that was regarding the Grecian widows. Anyway, the fact is that when people sold and when they decided with the proceeds, they decided to sell, when they decided with the proceeds and what part of the proceeds to bring and put under apostolic control, it was coming into a common area now. That was no longer theirs. It was under apostolic control for the apostles to make distribution as anyone had need. I'll say one other thing, and then there's a few one other thing, and there's a few comments I know. Today, we can think of it in the same way. When you and I, of our own free will, determine what to give on the first day of the week, when that money is given, it is under apostolic control. You and I no longer have the right as individuals with our own decisions about what we think we like the money. It's to be controlled by apostolic teaching about how that money ought to be used. And that's what a lot of this has been about when we speak about the work of the church, is about those funds that are collected and being used for the purpose for which they have been given, and that being something that is apostolically directed. So we have a few comments, and I think Denise and Chris, at least. Okay,
well, you touched on it briefly, which was they sold from their abundance. They did not make themselves a burden to the church, just selling everything, and now they couldn't support themselves. So it was from their abundance that they gave.
And they may have even sacrificed, but they wouldn't put themselves into a destitute situation where now they need to be helped.
Right.
You know, and 2 Corinthians chapter 8, we'll read after a bit, but we'll see that brought out, your very point. Chris.
A statement that stood out to me is that it's found in both of these places, and that is to speak specifically of those who had believed in chapter 2. In chapter 4, it was the congregation of those who believed. The money came, the funds came from those who believed. The believers didn't seek the outsiders to bring in the funds, like yard sales and things that we see, you know, other people. Mm-hmm. But it came from specifically from those who believed and was given to those who believe.
That's right. Very plain here, and that really comes out in that chapter 4. Speaking of the saints there, great grace was upon them all, for all who were possessors and brought the, and as anyone had need. Who's in the context here? saints. Yes, Troy.
Well, it's clear that Ananias and Sapphira died not because of the amount of money that they put down, but the lie of what they said they sold it for. They could have said, we sold it for, you know, different, but we're only giving this much.
That's right. And we don't even have all the details of how that happened. You know, when did this lie come up, or what did they do to promote this? Now, when she came in, Peter asked her, did you sell it for so much? And she said, yes. Mm-hmm. I'm assuming, I'm understanding that, you know, he's asking her, and then she's lying to him now. You know, how it happened earlier, I don't all know. But anyway, that's exactly right. While it was under their control, they could have given, they could have not given any, or they could have given whatever. And this shows the distinction between the Lord's money and your money. But once we give it, it's not under our discretion to just come up with ways. It's laid at the apostles' feet under their authority. Yes.
But it was the lie that cost them.
The lie that cost them. That's right. It was a lie. That's the important thing here. The example teaches us other things, but we've got to see that it was their sin was lying. Their sin was not holding back some of the proceeds. Okay. Anybody else have any other comments? I'd like to go on to some other scriptures here. So it's much later. I say much later. I believe it's around 45 A.D. when we get into Acts chapter 11 and verse 26. The time frame when Barnabas was sent to Antioch and went and got Paul and brought him, Saul as he was called then. The reason we would expect it around 45 AD, about 15 years later than the events of Acts 2, is because their secular history speaks to a famine at a particular time, and it was in that time frame of 45. And not only that, about the same time, Acts 12 records the death of Herod, and that's recorded in secular history, his death, and even the awfulness of his death by Josephus and stuff. And so this puts it 44, 45 in that. So here 15 years later, we have an occasion where there's going to be a famine. And so if we'll begin reading in Acts 11 and verse 27, Acts 11 and verse 27, the setting here is Antioch, Antioch of Syria. And this is where Barnabas and Saul have been now for a whole year, assembled with the church, teaching a great many people. Now verse 27, in these days, prophets came from Jerusalem to Antioch. Then one of them named Agabus stood up and showed by the Spirit that there was going to be a great famine throughout all the world, which also happened in the days of Claudius Caesar. Then the disciples, each according to his ability, determined to send relief to the brethren dwelling in Judea. This they also did and sent it to the elders by the hands of Barnabas and Saul. So here's an example where there is a known need. Now how good is prophecy? I'm sorry, I just had a thought. How certain is a prophecy of the Lord? 100%. Prophets came and said this was going to happen. And the disciples, almost it seems in a preemptive manner, said, knowing perhaps the situation, of course, there in Jerusalem, determined to send relief to brethren dwelling in Judea. They did not send it directly to the brethren that were in need, they sent it to the elders where the brethren were in need. In Acts, in verse 30, they did this and sent it to the elders by the hands of Barnabas and Saul. We see that messengers, Barnabas and Saul, were the messengers of this, carrying the funds. That means there's a concern about it getting to the right place and into the right hands. So it got to the right place, in the right hands, for the right purpose, and it was sent then to the elders. There were churches at this time, not only in Jerusalem, but there were disciples in Lydda, in Joppa. These are places in Judea, because the prophet Agabus said it was, verse 29 says they sent relief to the brethren who dwelt in Judea. How did they do it? The how. It was sent to the elders. There's a church in Jerusalem, there's one in Lydda, there's one in Joppa. What all churches are involved, we do not know. That's not stated here. Now, what some brethren have done, and maybe I'm introducing this to some soon, but some brethren have said that they sent it to the elders of the church in Jerusalem, and then the church in Jerusalem became then a sponsoring church to oversee the work of relieving saints all throughout Judea in other places. And there is that's an example of an unnecessary inference, and worse than that, it's not even an inference. It's not even an inference, and it's certainly not then a necessary inference. But it isn't even an inference to begin with. The money was sent to elders, and what are there to be? Acts 14 and 23. Elders in every church. Elders in every church. So what is this an example of? It's an example of a church, and I believe it is the church here in Antioch, sending relief to another church so that that church can relieve its needy saints. Now the word there is the disciples in verse 29. The disciples, each according to his ability, determined to send relief. The disciples. But who are the disciples back up in verses 26? What are the disciples known as here? When he had found him, he brought him to Antioch. It was that for a whole year they assembled with the church and taught a great many people. And the disciples, who are the disciples? They're the church at Antioch. They're the ones who make up the church at Antioch. They were first called Christians in Antioch. I believe we'll see as we go on through in the 2 Corinthians letter and 1 Corinthians that the church, like in Corinth, was taught to take up a collection. The church was not taught in Corinth. I'm getting ahead of myself, but the church in Corinth was not taught, and that's another case of benevolence, not this one. But it was not taught that when I come, I will go and collect money from all the individuals. They were specifically told to take up a collection so that when I come, there'll be no collections when I come. And so we'll look at that there after a bit in 1 Corinthians 16. The point I want us to see here is that aid was sent from one place to another to relieve those in another place. But who would be in charge of that relief in that place? The elders, that's right. The elders. The elders who not only shepherd or feed the flock with the word of God, but who what? Oversee bishops who oversee the work there in place. Any comments on that one? Yes.
So if a congregation doesn't have elders, can they receive funds?
In the absence of elders, if there's needy saints, I mean, we have to operate some way without elders when we don't have elder men who are qualified. I mean, that doesn't supersede the idea that the saints are supposed to take care of their own. And we go back to Acts chapter 2. Were there elders on the first day? There were apostles in place. In Acts 4, there were apostles. Elders are not even mentioned in Jerusalem until I mean, the Galatian letter, I believe, mentions, etc. But early on, we don't have mention of elders in Jerusalem. And even the apostles in Acts 6 said, appoint men among you to oversee a particular work of serving tables, which the word there is a serving word, as in, as more like a deacon, to oversee the actual distribution of things. But that would be my answer, Guy. I don't, you know, the work needs to be done. Paul did, I can't think of anything that would infer that if you don't have elders, then don't do this, don't do that, don't do this, don't do any of this unless you have elders. But why would it be sent to elders? Because they oversee the work. That's all I know to answer that. Troy?
You know, if you're a large company, there is ladders of responsibilities and power. You know, you have the supervisor, the assistant to the assistant, and on down the line. And, you know, we are basically the same thing, you know. Okay, we don't have elders, so then it goes down to the next step, and finally it comes down to the men that are in charge.
Mm-hmm. That's right. Yeah, that's a good way of looking at that, I believe. Is anyone, Chris?
Well, at chapter 6, they chose men
mm-hmm.
to oversee the work, and they weren't elders.
There weren't elders chose. Present.
Yeah.
Or they, yeah. Any other comments before we move to another example here? These will get into some more lengthy readings then in 2 Corinthians chapter 8 and 2 Corinthians 9. I have a note to myself that this was some now 15 years later, but now I'm questioning that because Acts 11 was 15 later than Acts 2, and I'm trying to recall the time frame of Paul's third journey as he's winding that up. Do you remember, Chris? Because I think about you teaching Galatians, and you spent some time, we might even have your old So we're getting close to 15 years. They say, people think it was around 58 to 60 about Paul's coming back to Corinth with the funds. 58 to 60. So maybe that's easy to remember. 15 years to Acts 11, 15 years to Acts 21 or so. Again, how would people date this? Well, one thing that is pinned down is when Paul was in Corinth on his second journey, Gallio was proconsul, and secular history gives a date for that. So there's date markers along the way that help us arrive at those kind of dates, 58 to 60. So here, Paul is on his third journey. And I believe he wrote the Second Corinthian letter pretty close to the First Corinthian letter. It was not a span of many years. But Paul is on his third journey, and he's going back to Jerusalem, and he has something for the needy saints in Jerusalem. Perhaps before we read 2 Corinthians 8 and 9, let's read Romans 15, a few passages from Romans 15. Because Paul is writing Romans from Corinth. And it's certainly, in writing it from Corinth, and that is based upon chapter 16 and verses 23, for example, he talks about Gaius, and you'll remember he talks about Crispus and Gaius and men like this who are in Corinth. But anyway, in chapter 15, Paul is telling what he's up to right now when he writes this letter, and that is in chapter 15 and verse 25. He says, "But now I'm going to Jerusalem to minister to the saints. For it pleased those from Macedonia and Achaia to make a certain contribution for the poor among the saints who were in Jerusalem. It pleased them indeed, and they are their debtors. For if the Gentiles have been partakers of their spiritual things, their duty is also to minister to them in material things." Paul's just saying there that look at where did the gospel begin? It began in Jerusalem among the Jews. It was first preached among the Jews. Did the Jews have a concern and a joy that the Gentiles were hearing the gospel? Yes, when Paul came back at the end of his first journey and he came back to Antioch where he'd been sent out from, he told them how God had opened the door of faith to the Gentiles. There's great rejoicing about all this. The Gentiles then have, quote, been partakers of their spiritual things. And now he says these Gentiles in places like Macedonia and Achaia are ministering to them material things which they need, the poor, the needy saints in Jerusalem. But the point here is that Paul is on his way to Jerusalem to minister to the needy saints with a contribution from these churches. Now in verse 30 and 31, he says, "Now I beg you, brethren, through the Lord Jesus Christ and through the love of the Spirit, that you strive together with me in your prayers to God for me, that I may be delivered from those in Judea who do not believe, and that my service for Jerusalem may be acceptable to the saints, that I may come to you with joy by the will of God and may be refreshed together with you." You recall that on the third journey, Paul knew about the troubles that awaited him in Jerusalem. It was being prophesied, and the Spirit was telling that chains and tribulations awaited him. He didn't know exactly how things would turn out. But he prayed that he'd be delivered, I suppose not be killed by those in Judea who don't believe. The itinerant, the angry Jews, indignant and angry Jews who were against Paul and against Christians. What is he doing, though? He's bringing something back to who? The saints. The saints. And so we see again in this case that, well, this occasion, Romans 15, 2 Corinthians 8, 9, 1 Corinthians 16, all talking about the same contribution, we'll see this as we go, is for needy saints in Jerusalem. And it's coming from them churches in Macedonia and Achaia. So that just sets the stage for what Paul is up to now. Because as we read 2 Corinthians chapter 8, we understand now what he's doing. And now what is he writing about in 2 Corinthians 8 and 9? Maybe before we read those, let's go to 1 Corinthians 16, verses 1 through 4. Because this was written before 2 Corinthians 8. And Paul writes, and he's writing from Ephesus. And that would have been on the third journey, rather the second. Is that the second journey or the third? Acts 19. Acts 19, the third journey. And Paul was in Ephesus 3 years. But he says in 16 and 8, 1 Corinthians 16 and 8, "I'll tarry in Ephesus until Pentecost." So this is the occasion when Paul's in Ephesus on his third journey. And he says this in chapter 16 and verse 1. "Now concerning the collection for the saints." If there was any doubt. "Now concerning the collection for the saints, as I have given orders to the churches of Galatia, so you must do also. On the first day of the week, let each one of you lay something aside, storing up as he may prosper, that there be no collections when I come. And when I come, whomever you approve by your letters, I will send to bear your gift to Jerusalem. But if it is fitting that I go also, they will go with me. The collection here about which Paul is discussing is a collection for saints. When we get to 2 Corinthians 8 and 9, we see that it's a collection for needy saints, the needy saints in Jerusalem. The way in which the church in Corinth was to be involved in this was for them to take up a collection. And it was to be a collection on the first day of the week. And you couldn't help but think back to Acts 2 and Acts 4, especially Acts 4 and 5, where people sold houses and lands and they gave of their own free will. They decided of their free will whether to sell. They decided of their free will how much to give. But what would they have been doing based on what we learn in 1 Corinthians 16 when we get all this together? They would have been putting into a common collection so that what? It was laid at the apostles' feet back there in Acts 4 so that they could make distribution. In this case, it's being stored up. For what reason? So that when Paul comes, then messengers can go with him back to Jerusalem. And he'd be happy to be the one to do it himself. It seems here, whomever you approve, I'll send to bear your gift. But if it is fitting that I go also, they will go with me. I guess he's just saying I could be a part of your... I could be one of your messengers. In addition to the ones you've chosen, I can be your messenger too. And I don't know what else. Any comments about what's going on here? Collection for needy saints somewhere else. Yes, Troy.
They couldn't wire money like we can now, or mm-hmm. transfer money bank to bank. You know, they had to take this cash and walk to wherever they're going to go, and they could face robbers or
yes.
something along the way, so they need to send enough men that they won't be robbed,
yeah.
that they can defend themselves, and the money is safely reaching its destination.
That's right. So it shows a concern that this money that is the Lord's money get to its destination and used for the purpose for which it was given. That's very important in this. In the 2 Corinthians chapter 8, you know, Paul brings out this idea of providing honorable things not only in the sight of the Lord but also in the sight of men. And the idea of the way it was a lavish gift he describes. And he wanted to do all things above board. And I think the messengers would help in that regard. Nowadays, like you say, we can send a check or we can wire money. And you can have confidence that it is received where it was sent and that it is the honorable, it's being done right in the sight of men. I had a thought and I've lost it again. But... any other thoughts? We'll get back now to 2 Corinthians 8. Oh, I was thinking about in Acts 20. Recall that when Paul was going to Troas, and this is, again, after, this is toward the end of his third journey, Luke records the names of many men. Now, why are they there? I don't know, but many of these men they're not from Jerusalem. They're from places like Thessalonica, Derbe, some from Asia. What has Paul been doing on this journey? He's picking up funds and picking up messengers with funds to take these funds to the needy saints in Jerusalem. And so Luke in Acts 20 and verse 4 gives some names of men who are from other places. Very possibly, we don't know for sure, but very possibly they're some of the messengers of the churches. from Thessalonica and these other places. And there are even, maybe I shouldn't mention it, but there's even speculation, too, about the way that they were traveling in Acts 20. And I don't recall what it was, but I read one time about some of the things that they were doing in Acts 20 because of how much they had in funds, that they would need to be awfully careful. Getting on a ship would be hard to hide a bag of clanging coins and things, I suppose. But let's go to 2 Corinthians 8, because we put all this picture together, and that's inductive reasoning. We're taking all of what God said on it, and we put it all together, and now we get a picture of that which pleases God and how it was done. Paul writes, before he gets to Corinth, this second letter on the third journey, before he gets to Corinth, he writes a second letter. And he sends Titus with that letter, is my understanding, based on what we read here in chapter 8. And here's this letter with Titus, and here's what it says, verse 8, chapter 8, verse 1. Moreover, brethren, we make known to you the grace of God bestowed on the churches of Macedonia, that in a great trial of affliction, the abundance of their joy and their deep poverty abounded in the riches of their liberality. For I bear witness that according to their ability, yes, and beyond their ability, they were freely willing, imploring us with much urgency that we should receive the gift and the fellowship of the ministering of the saints. And this they did, not as we had hoped, but first gave themselves to the Lord and then to us by the will of God. So we urge Titus that as he had begun, so he would also complete this grace in you as well. But as you abound in everything, in faith and speech and knowledge and all diligence and in your love for us, see that you abound in this grace also. As we continue reading, we'll see that Paul is encouraging them to complete the doing of that which they had decided or determined to do. That is, to take up collections, because he says, according to the New American Standard in 1 Corinthians 16, on the first day of every week. But verse 8, continuing in 2 Corinthians 8, I speak not by commandment, but I'm testing the sincerity of your love by the diligence of others. Paul gives us insight into why he's writing. He tells, look, here's what I'm doing with you. I'm testing you. I'm testing you out here. I'm giving you the example. You were Corinth and Achaia. I'm giving you the example of the churches of Macedonia, how giving they were. He's urging them through that example. He says, for you know the grace of our Lord Jesus Christ, that though he was rich, yet for your sakes he became poor, that you through his poverty might become rich. And in this I give my advice. It is to your advantage not only to be doing what you began and were desiring to do a year ago, but now you must also complete the doing of it. That as there was a readiness to desire it, so there also may be a completion out of what you have. It makes me think of times when I've determined in my mind I would help someone or something in some way, and then I never do it. But I had in my mind that I would do it, but for some reason I didn't complete the doing of it. Well, here's what Paul says to them as a church. He says, you have this in your mind and you've determined to do it. Now complete it. Complete the doing of it. Follow through with it. And he gives instruction. He says, for if there is first a willing mind, it is accepted according to what one has, and not according to what he does not have. You don't go take out a loan, if you could, I don't know. But you don't go take out a loan and make yourself destitute in order that you would help the needy saints. That is not what I'm telling you to do. He says, for I do not mean that others should be eased and you burdened. To your point, I think Denise or Troy made, of not to make yourself destitute so that now you need someone else to help you. Okay? And you know, I don't know if it goes through your mind, but you always have to ask yourself when you give, am I giving so much that then I would need someone else to help me? I don't know if that would ever occur to you. But anyway, you know, do we ever give that much that we have to cross that question in our mind? Anyway, we may do it in other ways. We may, you know, maybe it's with our time or some resource of ours. But anyway, for I do not mean that others should be eased and you burdened, but by an equality, that now at this time your abundance may supply their lack, that that their abundance also may supply your lack, that there may be equality. Again, Paul is not suggesting that there be equality in the sense of communistic society, but there be equality of want or need. That is, nobody is in want and need. That's the equality that ought to exist. We ought not to let our brethren be in need and want. There ought to be equality such that they are not in need and want just as we are not. That's just all this is about. And as it is written, he who gathered much had nothing left over, and he who gathered little had no lack. Thanks be to God who puts the same earnest care for you into the heart of Titus, for he not only accepted the exhortation, but being more diligent, he went to you of his own accord. So Titus wants to go to Corinth and help this to happen, and we've sent with him the brother whose praise is in the gospel throughout all the churches. Could be Timothy, we don't know. I don't think we know from other verses, but anyway. And not only that, but who was also chosen by the churches to travel with us with this gift, which is administered by us to the glory of the Lord himself and to show your ready mind. So here's a case of a messenger being chosen by more than one church. So avoiding this, that anyone should blame us in this lavish gift which is administered by us, providing honorable things not only in the sight of the Lord but also in the sight of men. And we have sent with them our brother, whom we have often proved diligent in many things, but now much more diligent because of the great confidence which we have in you. If anyone inquires about Titus, he's my partner and fellow worker concerning you. Or if our brethren are inquired about, they are messengers of the churches, the glory of Christ. Therefore show to them and before the churches the proof of your love and of our boasting on your behalf. In other words, go on through with what you've determined to do. Now chapter 9. Now concerning the ministering to the saints, it is superfluous for me to write to you, for I know your willingness, about which I boast of you to the Macedonians, that Achaia was ready a year ago, and your zeal has stirred up the majority. That's interesting. So a year ago, Achaia had this willingness to be a part of this, and Paul had used them as an example to Macedonians about their zeal, and that stirred them up. Yet, now verse 3, yet I have sent the brethren, lest our boasting of you should be in vain in this respect, that as I said, you may be ready, lest if some Macedonians come with me and find you unprepared, we, not to mention you, should be ashamed of this confident boasting. He's laying it on him, isn't he? Therefore, I thought it necessary to exhort the brethren to go to you ahead of time and prepare your bountiful gift beforehand, which you had previously promised, that it may be ready as a matter of generosity and not as a grudging obligation. I want you and your heartstrings to be tugged, and you not for us to just show, I'm putting in my own words, kind of like this. I don't want to show up and then you just suddenly feel obliged. Kind of like someone sees the plate come down the aisle in the church building and they say, oh, what are people going to think? Let me pull out a dollar bill and stick it in or something. That's not the kind of giving that Paul wants the church in Corinth to be involved in. He wants them out of a willingness and a ready heart. And he goes on about that. He says, but this I say, he who sows sparingly will also reap sparingly, and he who sows bountifully will also reap bountifully. So let each one give as he purposes in his heart, not grudgingly or necessity, for God loves a cheerful giver. And God is able to make all grace abound toward you, that you always having all sufficiency in all things may have an abundance for every good work. As it is written, He has dispersed abroad, He has given to the poor, His righteousness remains forever. Now may He who supplies seed to the sower and bread for food supply and multiply the seed you have sown and increase the fruits of your righteousness, while you are enriched in everything for all liberality, which causes thanksgiving through us to God. For the administration of this service not only supplies the needs of the saints, but also is abounding through many thanksgivings to God, while through the proof of this ministry, they glorify God for the obedience of your confession of the gospel of Christ, and for your liberal sharing with them and all men, and by their prayer for you, who long for you because of the exceeding grace of God in you. Thanks be to God for this indescribable gift. The church in Corinth, and back to the lesson, the church in Corinth is being encouraged to make a collection, make collections that Paul and their messengers would pick up and take back to the needy saints in Jerusalem. Such would accomplish two things, at least. One would be it would supply their needs back in Jerusalem to the needy saints. Secondly, it would create much thanksgiving to God as those needy saints in Jerusalem rejoice over your receipt of the gospel, your obedience to the gospel, and not only that, your demonstration of how it's affected you in your life in Corinth, such that you would give for needy Jews back in Jerusalem. And you can just hear the praise and the thanksgiving in Paul's voice here. Thanks be to God for His indescribable gift. They will glorify God for hearing of your obedience to the gospel and your sharing with them. Again, we see in 2 Corinthians 8, 9, and also in 1 Corinthians 16, this was for the saints. Now, next week, we'll continue maybe wrapping this up and drawing some points out. But we'll discuss at least a couple reasons why I've heard people suggest that the church collect money to help non-saints. It's not in the scriptures. It's not right. But I do want to share at least some reasons, and we'll see why those are valid reasons in the scriptures for doing that. There are eight scriptures Acts 2, we saw Acts 4, Acts 6, I skipped over that one, we'll go back to it, Acts 6, Acts 11, 1 Corinthians 16, 2 Corinthians 8, 2 Corinthians 9, and Romans 15. Eight scriptures, and in every case, it is clear that the collection was for who? Saints. And so we'll continue next week. Does anyone have any comments? Troy?
Just a real quick one. Nowhere in there that you read did it say that we have to give X amount. Some churches want 10% and 5%. That's not in the scriptures.
That's right.
There is not a dollar amount in the scriptures or a percentage in the scriptures of what we have to give.
That's right. That's correct. Any other thoughts?